Recent statistics indicate that approximately 22% of Canadians, or 6 million people, will meet the criteria for a substance abuse disorder in their lifetime. Within this group, adolescents have the highest rate of substance abuse or dependence. This group is of particular concern not only because they have the highest rates of abuse or dependence, but also because they potentially have greater impacts from their substance abuse. During adolescence, the brain is still developing. Thus, exposure to toxic substances such as alcohol and drugs can disrupt the natural process of brain development and maturation, resulting in subsequent defects in academic, social, and occupational functioning. Additionally, another layer of complexity to this issue is how substance abuse disorders and mental health disorders tie into this already complex situation. While an individual can have both a substance abuse disorder and a mental illness with no impact on each other, emerging research has found that underlying mental illness can impact substance abuse, as well as substance abuse at an early age can increase the likelihood of individuals developing a mental illness later in life. In today's episode, which is the first part of a two-part series, we will be discussing substance abuse and mental health disorders. And more specifically, we will be bringing on Dr. Jabrong Kokar, an associate professor at Western University in the Anatomy and Cell Biology Department, to discuss these topics further. Dr. Kokar completed his PhD at the University of Toronto and his BSc at Queen's University. His lab's research aims are to understand the mechanisms underlying co-occurring serious mental illness and substance use disorders. They do this using a variety of behavioral, pharmacological, and translational neuroimaging techniques. In addition to this, his research interests also include assessing the long-term effects of adolescent drug use and how these effects might contribute to the risk for serious mental illness and addiction. The World Health Organization defines adolescence as the phase of life between childhood and adulthood from 10 to 19 years of age. It is a unique stage of human development and an important time for laying the foundations of good health. Adolescents experience rapid physical, cognitive, and psychosocial growth. Given that there is so much happening neurologically during this time, Dr. Kokar, would you be able to give an overview on some of the neurodevelopmental changes that are occurring in adolescence, as well as how might substance abuse during this time affect brain development?
Adolescence is a period of social, physical, behavioral change in humans and in animals. This is where you start to see a shift from affiliation to parents to then affiliation to peers. And then at the same time, there is development happening at the brain level that, and uniquely, adolescence is a period where now with the super fast, almost accelerated growth of the brain during the early developmental post-birth period, this is a period to sort of pull back and apply the brakes on that high rate of development. So what you end up seeing at the level of the brain is pruning. So now that those connections between those neurons have developed, some of those are pruned back to get the brain to now function optimally for what's next, which is that transition into adulthood. But in addition to that, you are actually also seeing a considerable shift in each of the individual neurotransmitter systems in the brain. And these neurotransmitter or neuromodulatory systems in the brain all play different roles. Some are excitatory, others are inhibitory, others just modulate that excitatory or inhibitory activity within the brain. And within that, you see shifts in both the receptors, where these neurotransmitters act or the neuromodulators act, as well as the levels of those neurotransmitters or neuromodulators, as well as the levels of the enzymes that either make them or break them. And so there's a lot of moving parts that are changing at the same time. And adolescence ends up being one of those periods where you do see a lot of that flux. So those are all changes that essentially help to get the brain into a more mature state to then deal with that next step of adulthood. So going back to where we started in the first question, because this is a period of the shift in the social model or the social context that the adolescents are in, that increased peer affiliation comes with its own influences as they relate to substance use. But in addition to that, this is a period while that brain is developing and not fully developed, it is a period of greater risk-taking behavior, and you see that across humans and animals. Greater impulsive-like behavior, and you again see that between humans and animals. And so all of those things essentially create for a perfect storm that then, as it relates to substance use. And substance use, you know, in a lot of ways can be described as a pediatric condition, especially when you look at the earlier you start, regardless of what substance it is, the greater your risk of developing a substance use disorder later on in life. And so it becomes that unique period where not only do you have your social context that's impacting, and not then you have your brain development that's impacting it. And then on top of that, you then have the additional fact that most substance use does start during this time. And so all of those form this confluence of factors that then really makes adolescence a unique period for when it comes to substances. As far as effects of the substances on the brain, let's think about the substances, right? The substances have to act through one of the existing systems in the brain. If it's vaping nicotine, then it's interacting with nicotinic acetylcholine receptors in the brain. If it's alcohol, then it's acting on GABAergic receptors as well as other, you know, ion channels within the brain. If we're talking about cannabis, cannabis is interacting with your endocannabinoid system. If you're talking about opioids, opioids are interacting with the opioidergic system within the brain. So the targets for these drugs are different and play very different roles within the brain. And so while we can generalize to say that there are some factors that are sort of drug, not drug specific, or can be seen across various drugs, there are others that are going to be related specifically to the drugs. And so the three big domains where you see effects, in especially studies that have come out with humans, and these are association studies, adolescent substance use has been associated with effects in three primary domains. The first one would be increased risk of substance use later on in life, or at least not just substance use, but also substance use disorder. And the other one would be psychopathology, and so how it's been linked to greater risk for anxiety, depression, schizophrenia, depending on which drug you're talking about. And, you know, these are associations and causality has not been established in one direction or another. And then the last one that has been shown from association and human imaging studies is cognitive dysfunctions or effects in the cognitive domain. And so depending on which drug it is, it may affect one of these domains more than the other. And you do see that with things like alcohol compared to nicotine, for example, or alcohol compared to even opioids. But that your mileage may vary depending on which drug it is, when it's taken, and which of those domains or effects that you look at after. But some other effects are more domain general, and you do see if there is substance use during adolescence, that impulsivity that we were talking about is in fact exacerbated by the use of substances. And so I think there are some factors or some effects that are present across multiple drugs.
I know that substance abuse disorder in adolescence is an active area of research for you and your lab, and I was wondering if you could speak a bit about what specific topics or areas you're currently researching and anything interesting you may have found.
Yeah, so, you know, by no means am I the first or the last to study this topic. There are great researchers who have worked on this topic for a long time, and we all stand on the shoulders of giants, and in this case, one being Linda Speer, who passed away a few years ago out of Binghamton University. But she has done a lot of the work that, you know, essentially forms the basis of the work that we do in the lab in terms of characterizing, you know, what ages correlate to human adolescence in rodent models or in models, non-human primate models. And so there are a lot of people that have looked at the effects of drugs, especially during this period. Where we maybe differentiate ourselves from a lot of that work is in two domains. The first one being really trying to get ahead of the current patterns of use. Substance use 10, 20, 30 years ago looked very different from what it looks like now, with the emergence of vaping, with the emergence of edibles, with the emergence of different forms. In fact, the things that were popular back then are actually on their way down. And so you see that where adolescents are smoking way less than they used to, they're drinking less than they used to. And so I think those are important shifts in that. And then we also live in Canada where cannabis has been legalized. And so that's another important piece of the puzzle. The other important piece of the puzzle that we try to tackle in the lab is that when it comes to substance use, especially during adolescence, co-use or use of multiple substances is the rule and not the exception. And so oftentimes a lot of the studies have just, they'll inject rats or mice or whatever the animal is with nicotine and then make conclusions about the effects of nicotine. Or they'll inject them with THC and then make conclusions about the effects of THC. But as far as the humans are concerned, they're also vaping nicotine and they're vaping cannabis and they're drinking alcohol at the same time. And so I think that's another important piece that maybe our lab does differentiate from others in, is that we look at the effects of co-exposure to alcohol and nicotine vapor, alcohol and cannabis vapor, cannabis and nicotine vapor together. And so trying to figure out what are the additional impacts if you do either try to look at the mode of delivery that's more consistent with how the human deliver it, or the combination of the substances, which is more akin to how the humans use it. And so those would be two factors that we are looking at in terms of it being an active area of research. And we combine that with either non-invasive or invasive assessments of neural circuitry, either through using MRI-based neuroimaging or looking at electrophysiological local field potential recordings of brain circuitry to look at how does that exposure change both the behavior and the function of those neural circuits that underlie that behavior.
Thank you for sharing a little bit about the research you and your lab do. That all sounds really, really interesting. Something else that I wanted to ask about is, I was wondering if there is any research currently being done on ways to reduce or reverse the neurobiologic effects of substance abuse in adolescence, and if so, where is that field currently at?
Yeah, so it all depends on the change. Some changes are more longer lasting than others, and others you recover from. So that is definitely a focus in the lab. In our lab, what we're hoping to do is actually look at that neural circuit basis, but also through longitudinal assessments, we are hoping to see if we can find that inflection point. Where does that risk trajectory change? You know, things are proceeding as they would, and then this is the point where now things shift, or that you see that inflection in that risk trajectory. And the goal is, by understanding what those circuit changes are, hopefully we can then intervene to change it. This could be either pharmacologically or through a neuromodulation-based tool. And we're not the only ones thinking of it. Others are also trying different agents, you know, something that Kuei Sang and even Steve LaViolette here at Western have tried is seeing how they might be able to alter GABAergic neurotransmission and how that might reverse some of that effect, at least as they relate to cannabis exposure or cannabinoid exposure. Others have looking at alcohol or nicotine and looked at how we may be able to either change receptor function or change that circuitry to reverse some of that. So I think there are many approaches to go after, but I think the goal of trying to characterize is just that. I think most people who are trying to characterize those changes at the level of the circuit and the behavior are doing it with the hopes that then hopefully they can intervene and either reduce or reverse those effects.
Thank you for that. That was really interesting. To switch things up a bit, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what it's like being a professor and what your day-to-day or even week-to-week looks like.
Professors are essentially, if you took three jobs and mushed them into one, that's what a professor's job is. There's the research piece, so we're writing grants, managing projects, writing papers about those findings from those projects, disseminating findings. And so I end up traveling to give talks on the new findings that we have. And so that's the research piece. Then we have the teaching piece where then you're designing courses and you're presenting the material and you're grading and you're doing all of those things that the fun stuff that goes on with teaching. And then you also have a service component because you're scholars, you have, you owe it to society to serve in a variety of ways. And so we serve on committees for students for their PhD thesis or their master's thesis. We serve on boards and advisory boards, either for professional organizations or local community organizations. I, for example, serve on the Canadian Mental Health Association, the local chapter board. In addition to that, you serve towards your societies and that you're a member of. And so you help organize conferences, you give symposia, and you present talks, and you review grants from other scientists, and you review papers from other scientists. And so, because it's three jobs mushed into one, it's kind of a lot of juggling of different sized balls, including some that are bowling balls. The example I often use is like you end up kicking a lot of cans down the road until you have to deal with one because it's caught on fire. And so that's kind of a professor's job.
It sounds like there really is a lot of different components to your job. Do you have a favorite part?
I think my favorite part is seeing the excitement from the trainees, where they're like, "Oh, I just got this cool piece of data," and you can feel it's like palpable, right? And that nothing motivates you more as a professor than seeing that like next generation of scientists sort of developing and helping them along their path wherever it is, whether they want to do a PhD or a master's, whether they want to work in academia or they want to work in industry or they want to be clinicians or whatever is helping them get to where they want to go. That for me, it would be my favorite.
Oh, that's really great. I saw recently in an article on Western's website that you were appointed a Canadian research chair. I was wondering if you could speak a bit on that and what it means to hold that title.
Yeah, so Canada Research Chair is a mechanism that they created in Canada to both help attract and retain research talent in Canada. And so that was actually part of my recruitment to Western. And yes, it does come with some funding, but most of the funding is for essentially recruiting me and, paying for my salary and all of those things. But it does come with some research funding as well. But it's really the mechanism is to both attract and retain research talent in Canada because of how our funding system has been malnourished for many years, there is a huge brain drain. A lot of or other scientists that I know that end up going to the US for postdoctoral training, for example, never return back to Canada. So this is one such mechanism, but that does help to either attract or retain scientific researchers in Canada.
Thank you all for joining us today on our first episode of our two-part series on substance abuse disorder and mental illness. Unfortunately, this is all the time we have today. Next episode, we will again be joined by Dr. Jibran Kokar, where we will be diving into this topic further and exploring the additional topics of adolescent nicotine use and its effect on the developing brain, as well as exploring the topic of co-occurring disorders and how they impact individuals. It is sure to be an interesting episode, so be sure not to miss it.